This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from East Baton Rouge Parish Mayor's Office, Sharon Weston Broom, and the show originates from the Investar Tower in Baton Rouge. 877-217-5757 is your number. That's 877-217-5757. And emails to talk@talklouisiana.org. Robin Dow and Renee Martin are producing, and Fred Dent is in, the financial analyst, who is also an underwriter for this program. And he is here to talk about what's going on in the world of 2024. And folks, we're, I think it's 27 weeks from the election as of yesterday. So we're getting closer and closer. And the conventional wisdom is that markets respond to what's happening politically. And right now the Fed is holding tight. Interest rates are not coming down as quickly as many thought they would. And that does affect the stock market. If you've noticed, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has not done real well the last few weeks. And I was interested that MSNBC, when it was getting up around 40,000 was the Dow, they were all over that story. And now that's been dropping, they're totally ignoring it, which is unfortunate because you got to report the news, whether it's good or bad. Fred, why is it going down the last few weeks?
Well, we've interest rates, as you mentioned, but we've also had a tremendous run with stocks over the last year and into this year to date. It just goes to prove that the economy cannot be reliably forecast, nor can the market be timed, because people have been calling for a recession for over 2 years now, watching the yield curve and all of those things saying it's imminent, and yet it hasn't materialized. And in that time, the S&P 500 over the last 2 years is up 40% with dividends.
Well, the market should always be going up. That's why when they say there's a record high, there should always be a record high in the market, because that doesn't necessarily mean the market's growing that much either. You should always be going ahead. And over time, we know the Dow. I remember when Bill Clinton took office on January 20th, 1993, 31 years ago, the Dow was at 3240. Today, even with a 2,000 point drop over the last few weeks, it's at 37,863, which means over 31 years, if you had invested in the stock market and the Dow Jones Industrial Average as the barometer, you would have more than 10 times. So if you invested $100,000 in 1993, you'd be well over $1 million today. So, Fred, I know I'm preaching to the choir, but there are ups and downs, and if you get into individual stocks, you can either hit it big or you can lose your shirt, and that's the nature of the beast. You have a philosophy that spreads the risk, don't you?
Yeah, we don't do individual stocks. We do sectors, exchange-traded funds, mutual funds that invest broadly, but include all of those big names and those big performers here to date, for example, Microsoft and NVIDIA and Amazon, et cetera. So If you own the S&P 500 stocks, you own those big stocks, Walmart, Exxon. Those are some of the top big components of that.
Well, and the listener, this invariably comes up. It's the most talked about stock is Tesla. It had a terrible earnings report, and the stock was cratering, and then suddenly it's gone back up over the last few weeks.
Yeah, well, Tesla's volatile. The whole EV market is mercurial and changing, and I don't follow it that closely. If you live in California like my sister, EVs make sense in terms of having a station readily available to recharge. If you live in the South where we do, it's a little bit more of a challenge.
Well, here's a headline, New York Times today. High rates barely affecting Americans who own assets. With more than 2 years after the Federal Reserve started lifting interest rates to restrain growth and weigh on inflation, businesses continue to hire, consumers continue to spend, and policymakers are questioning why their increases have not had a more aggressive bite. The answer probably lies in a simple reality. High interest rates are not really pinching Americans who own assets like houses and stocks as much as many economists might have expected. So what it has done is, if you're in a house and you want to move to another house, you're probably not likely to do that, or as likely, because you're going to have to pay higher interest rates.
If you strip out the housing component of the consumer price index, inflation is only running around 2%, which is a long-term average. Housing still remains high. But if you have a house, yes, you're locked in. You don't have to go out and buy a house. If you need a house, then you are kind of behind the eight ball on that. But inflation is real. If I go back to the year 2000, Since COVID, the cost of groceries that you buy every day at Walmart or wherever you shop is up 36%. Automobile insurance premiums are up 44% since COVID. So things are getting expensive and have remained expensive.
Here's another story as of April 20th, and a good one. Homeowners hanging on to lower mortgage rates. This one also from the New York Times. Something deeply unusual has happened on the American housing market. In the last 2 years, mortgage rates have now risen to just over 7%, and rates that high are not by themselves historically remarkable. The trouble is that the average American household with a mortgage is sitting on a fixed rate that's a whopping 3 points lower. So if the housing market is stalled, what does that do to the overall economy, and what does it do to stocks, if anything?
Well, certainly housing stocks it would affect, but I don't think it's going to affect the overall economy per se. We do have a frozen housing market because of the reasons that you mentioned. But the companies that make up the components of the S&P 500, and I just use that as an example, index, they're doing well. They're announcing record profits. Amazon just announced, oh my gosh, record revenues. And all of those components are doing very well.
877-217-5757 for Fred Dent. David in Atlanta. David, you're on Talk Louisiana.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen. The Trump campaign, should Trump be reelected, they want more control. They want more control given to the president for monetary policy to control interest rates. Given when Trump had fiscal policy control, he added almost $8 trillion to the national debt. Would be given Trump more control over interest rates, wouldn't that be like giving a flamethrower to an arsonist?
David from Atlanta, always a pleasure.
David
to
from
hear
Atlanta,
from you.
And of course Nikki Haley hit Trump hard on that $8 trillion rise in the debt, and the debt, of course, has continued to go up under Joe Biden, although not as much. Hasn't gone up $8 trillion in 4 years, but it's gone up, and we've been swimming in red ink, and the only way you can reduce the debt is to not have a deficit. And that's impossible right now because we're at a level where if we completely obliterated the debt, the economy would be devastated. So, Fred, what are we going to do, whether it's Biden, whether it's Trump, whether it's Bobby Kennedy Jr.? Are we still going to be swimming in red ink in this country?
Most likely. But if you look at the economic – well, let me back up and say that tax policy will be the most important economic determinant of the outcome of this election. And if Republicans are reelected, they're probably going to extend the Trump tax cuts. And that will mean, of course, lower taxes, but higher deficits. And if Biden wins, well, there will be a call to raise taxes and
on those that have assets.
Yeah, there is a movement to tax assets per se.
Well, but those who have assets generally have more money, and that you got to fish where the fish are. But for those deficit hawks, and many of whom call themselves conservative, the reality is that Clinton reduced the Bush deficit and the Reagan deficit, and he actually left with a surplus. And then Bush spent like a drunken sailor, and we had left with a huge deficit under him. Obama brought that deficit down, although it was still a deficit, but he brought it down, which means the debt was increasing, but not as much. And then Trump brings it up to an all-time high, and then Biden's brought the deficit down, although not down appreciably, not down enough that we're not having a huge, huge problem with red ink. When does it give? We've got over 20% of our obligation now to debt service. At some point, that number becomes a real threat, and we may already be there. Are we there now, or are we getting close? Where are we?
I have no idea. Markets have seemed to shrug it off in terms of interest rates. I mean, they are higher, but and that has affected our debt service. But I don't know where it becomes the tipping point.
Mm-hmm. And a listener notes it's time to get Lauren Scott back, because back in the day, he would say deficits are not really that important. I have a feeling he may have changed his tune on that, because he would say, Jim, you have a deficit. You have a personal deficit. You have a house note. You have a car note. You have bills to pay that you have to keep the trains rolling. You got to keep making money, and probably you have to at some point make more money than you are now, but you're betting on the come that you'll do that. We're running the country like a personal approach to finances, it would seem.
What I remember Lauren Scott talking about is specifically a trade deficit, and you and I run trade deficits. For example, we have a trade deficit with Walmart. When I go to Walmart and buy stuff, Walmart doesn't buy from me. but somehow it works out through the economy that it gets all worked out. And that's what he was talking about, and I think, when he talked about deficits.
Well,
not talking, about debt specifically.
He actually said deficits at one point really are not that big of a deal. And Reagan proved that you can make the economy stimulated by running red ink. And if the people are not worried about it, it's no big deal because stock market's going up. They got more money in their pocket. They're feeling good, and they're not worried about long-term effects that may affect their children and grandchildren.
Here are the questions that investors should be asking themselves. 10 years from now, will the stock market most likely be higher or lower? If you think it's going to be most likely higher, then own stocks. Will the housing market be higher or lower? If you think house prices will rise, then now is the time to buy a house in the next 10 years.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. Fred Denton in the house. We'll return after this short pause. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. And Fred Dent with us for a few minutes longer, the financial analyst and underwriter for this show. And we're talking about the American economy, and no big secret, and this is something that's been going on through administrations that were Republican and Democratic, that if you've got money, you're better off than those who don't. That makes sense. But the gap, and a listener asked, this is Hal in Monroe, about is the gap growing? And the New York Times in its recent story says the answer probably lies in a rate, in part to a simple reality. High interest rates are not really pinching Americans who own assets like houses and stocks as much as many economists might have expected, but some people are feeling the squeeze. Credit rates have skyrocketed. Rising delinquencies on auto loans suggest that people with lower incomes are struggling under their weight. So do we have a real issue in our country right now between those who are doing well and those who are not doing well?
Yes. Because, as I mentioned earlier about those inflation numbers at the grocery store, in the last, since 2000, up 36%, automobile insurance premiums up 44%. I mean, the people who have less income are severely affected by those numbers and that inflation. So, indeed, their real purchasing power has shrunk dramatically.
877-217-5757, if you'd like to get under the wire with Fred Dent. Dan downtown. Dan, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, Mr. Dent, is there any truth to Senator Sanders' solution to the deficit by having the rich in corporate America pay its fair share in taxes?
We only have a minute left, right? That's such a broad question.
On a percentage rate, though, most rich people don't pay as much as middle-class people because they have ways to use the system to shield assets, to what we would call loopholes that enable them to do so. Donald Trump doesn't pay any taxes.
I'm not in the 1%, but I read a statistic the other day that 40% of all taxes are paid by the 1%. I mean, the tax burden does rise higher. I don't believe that Donald Trump, unless he's got some tax loss carry forward.
He's in real estate, so yeah. That's a whole different deal because there are other, he obviously is paying property taxes.
But, indeed.
But income taxes, not so much. But there are those who say that the 1% have much more than 40% of the assets, too. But you're saying they're paying 40% of the taxes.
I don't know the exact breakdown, but I don't think, I just don't know.
Okay. 877-217-5757. And this, Robin's been sitting on this cut for a little while. A few months ago in California when Trump was running for president, he says these inflammatory things so often that it's hard to keep track of what he says. But this is a listener, and the reason I'm trying to get her to pull this cut up, and she's nodding, she's got it, and she knows what we're talking about. Shoplifting, a big part of the drain on retailers in America, they build in an expense for shoplifters. And Trump says he has a solution. Let's get the Donald on, the former president of the United States, number 45 on the honor roll, on what he would do to curb shoplifting in America. And he said this in Los Angeles a few months ago.
You know, these people are killing people when they go into the stores. You'll have 300 young people who are not looking for a good future walk into a store, big department store, and just pillage it. And if you happen to be there when they're there, they'll knock the hell out of you and kill you in some cases. And we will immediately stop all of the pillaging and theft. Very simply, if you rob a store, you can fully expect to be shot as you are leaving that store. Shot.
I don't think it would be a good idea to do shoplifting in a gun store per se, because that would be a death sentence.
Well, and some of these people might shoot back and hit passerby, other people who are going around the grocery store with their shopping carts. I don't think we want shootouts in Albertsons.
No, and that plays well to the base. And the reality is there are some significant shoplifting issues. Killing people is not the answer, in my humble opinion.
Well, and it is interesting that guys like our former president, who are not in good shape, their first instinct is to protect themselves with a gun. you don't want to bite on that
one. I'm going to stay out of the gun debate.
Okay, well... Robin says she's got another one. This is Trump from 8 years ago when he was running the first time, the winning campaign over Hillary Rodham Clinton, in which the former president was commenting on what he would like to do to people who acted up at his rallies. Do we have it? Let's go.
Bye-bye. Look, see, he's smiling. See, he's having a good time. I love the old days, you know? You know what I hate? There's a guy totally disruptive, throwing punches. We're not allowed to punch back anymore. I love the old days. You know what they used to do to guys like that when they were in a place like this? They'd be carried out on a stretcher, folks.
And that played well enough for him to win the 2016 election. Yeah. He hasn't changed his tune a whole lot either, has he?
You're dragging this investment guy into the mire of...
Well, this does affect the economy. If we have shootouts of shoplifters, which is what
there will be fewer consumers to buy goods, indeed.
They would be... Cemeteries would be
right. So,
a good place to invest, right?
Indeed.
I remember once a guy who owned a funeral home asked me if I would be interested in buying it. He said, Jim, it's a recession-proof industry.
People are dying to get into it.
Yeah, people are dying to get into it. But as we found out during COVID, there were fewer funerals, weren't there?
A lot of cremations.
A lot of cremations. That's the way to go. And God bless. I love cemeteries. I love visiting cemeteries. I just never want to be in one.
Well, when you visit them, where are you?
Well, I go, and when I go to cities, I often go to cemeteries. My favorite is the Westwood Memorial Cemetery in Los Angeles. That's my favorite because, you know, I feel like I know a lot of those people. In fact, they even found the unmarked grave of George C. Scott, and I stand on it. I say, Patton, I know you're in there. You're in there, Patton. But my favorite inscription, and I would have taken it, but it's already been taken, Merv Griffin, he's on his. It says, I will not be right back after this message. And he's buried right next to Rodney Dangerfield, and his says, there goes the neighborhood.
This is a macabre fascination, Jim.
Yes, it is.
Tell us more.
But back to the markets. Where are we going? You think it's going to be a good year?
It's been a good year so far. Last year was a great year. What I always say is that the market's going to take 2-3 steps forward and then 1 or 2 steps back. And nobody can consistently time it. As a matter of fact, there's a guy who died recently named Daniel Kahneman. Some people may recognize that name. He won the Nobel Prize for Economics. Specifically behavioral economics, and he said that, quote, all of us would be better investors if we just made fewer decisions.
Well, people, it's amazing what strikes the fancy of our listening, the most educated audience in the history of radio. They ask, where do I like to go in Baton? Magnolia Cemetery. Great cemetery. Did you know that Abe Lincoln's brother-in-law was buried there? He was killed in the Battle of Baton Rouge. They exhumed him and brought him to another place, but he died fighting for the South.
Where is that cemetery?
It's right downtown. They used to have a great thing with Society for Historical Louisiana, and they would reenact things. But there's some great stories about, and maybe that's why, I know some of the stories behind people who were buried there. And Patrick in Innisfail Estates not so long ago said he visited a cemetery here in Baton Rouge. And Rest Haven? I think it's Rest Haven. Pete Maravich and Don Redden are buried right next to each other, and two great LSU basketball players. And Rest Haven, that's exactly where it is. So
I grew up in Collegetown near LSU, and there was a cemetery there called Collegetown Cemetery. When I was in fourth grade, I smoked my first cigarette there.
In the cemetery?
In the cemetery, hiding out with my friends. And you'll see many first families of Baton Rouge names in that cemetery from the Civil War, like Klein Peter and Favreau and things of that nature.
Well, there's the Highland Cemetery, right? Historic cemetery that Mr. Klein Peter has been on this show and talked about. So
no, that's the Collegetown Cemetery. So he tends to that one.
Okay. All right. I think that he calls it another name, but I know the one you're talking about. But yeah. But hopefully we won't be in a cemetery for a while. And the markets are such that people are living longer. Investors are older by virtue of the fact that we have an older populace. And as we get older, as we finish our segment with Fred, if you're 75, should your approach be different than somebody who's 25?
Depends on your situation. Some people have money where they want to leave assets to their children, and they want those assets to continue to grow. But if somebody doesn't have as much, then they turn on the income stream, and it has to be more conservative.
Thank you, sir. See you soon. Back after this, Ted James is on deck, the man running for mayor. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana. And we turn the page and we're joined in studio by former state representative Ted James, lawyer from Baton Rouge, who is running for mayor president. The election is just over 6 months away, November 5th, I believe. This is May 1st, May Day. And good morning to you, Ted James.
Good morning, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing well. Good. Well, got a little ground to cover. What about St. George? What do you make of this?
Well, you know, from day one, I was a strong advocate for us, you know, maintaining the city of Baton Rouge, you know, from my early days in the legislature. So disappointed in the outcome. But as I stated when I ran for office, when we made the announcement, now that they're part of the, you know, parish and their new city, I intend to work just as hard with the citizens of St. George as I committed to do with Baker, Zachary, and Central once elected.
But what do you think, based on the early read, what are the repercussions of this?
You know, it's going to, you know, severely impact all of us financially. Don't agree with the numbers and that, you know, we're going to be able to efficiently run a new city with the numbers that have been presented. We have, you know, a lot of ground to cover, and that for 4 years, the transition committee, they've been working. And what I watched on Monday was, a group very well prepared to go into this negotiation with the city parish. And for us, I don't know if Baton Rouge has been at the table for 4 years, right? And, you know, what this means for basic services. I have family members that lived in a proposed city. You know, I'm very close to the line, and it's going to be a very long and drawn out process. And it's going to, you know, I think the folks in St. George are going to be looking at some tax increases, just like the folks in Zachary and Central had to do.
But people who own property, they're saying that inevitably it's likely that property in St. George will escalate, and property in Baton Rouge will not, or not as fast, or maybe even go down. Is that a real concern?
You know, I think that once, you know, I'm elected and we're going to make sure that we improve the infrastructure in the city of Baton Rouge and across the parish. I've heard from several residents who are looking at moving into Baton Rouge. I was, you know, slated to go to a meeting yesterday evening, and a young lady and her husband canceled because they were looking at property in Baton Rouge. So I think that right now you're going to see a lot of that going back and forth. I intend to, you know, improve the infrastructure here, and we're going to look at how we are, mm-hmm. you know, aggressively tackling home ownership. And for me, I have a lot more positive outlook for the city of Baton Rouge.
Again, 877-217-5757 for Ted James, who is running for mayor, and he was a state rep. He became a leader in the Small Business Association in the Biden administration and Small Business Administration. And he is now making his case that he wants to be the leader of his hometown. And in Baton Rouge, we have the largest parish in Louisiana. And the parish government does not change. And I don't know, I mentioned it to Mayor Broom yesterday. He was on with us briefly. But there were a lot of people who thought, I think, when they voted, the 54% who did, that the mayor president of East Baton Rouge Parish would no longer be the leader. That role is really not changing.
Not at all. And unfortunately, as I've talked to people across the parish, even, you know, folks in Zachary, as I've campaigned, you know, folks, Ted, I wish I could vote for you, but I live in Zachary. And I'm like, yeah, you're still in the parish. So one of my concerns with this movement from day one was the lack of information that was getting out to people. And I know that there are several individuals that went into the voting booth not fully aware. And I think that that's a twofold problem. Mm-hmm. Those of us that are elected and appointed and leaders, we should do a better job of getting that information out. And those folks, before you go to the polls, you have to make sure that you research these issues. I would have worked a lot harder and during the campaign process to make sure that we were getting the information out there to people.
877-217-5757. And Tom on Bluebonnet talks about the dynamics of this race. Right now, there are two major candidates. It's likely a Republican will get in the race, but right now we don't know. And Tom makes a good point that in previous elections, with the exception of Kip Holden when he ran for re-election, basically most of the black people vote for the black candidate, the black Democrat, and most of the white people vote for the Republican candidate, the white Republican. But in this case, you've got two prominent black Democrats running against each other. So I would say, and Tom's probably right, that the white people in the city may end up choosing which of the two black Democrats will be the mayor. So how do you appeal to people who may not share your viewpoint of Baton Rouge or the world at large?
The good thing is this is not new to me. I've always appealed and worked well with individuals that on paper, based on their political affiliation, their age or their race, I guess should not believe or work with me. And I think that the support that I'm receiving in this campaign with, former elected officials who are Republican, who are supporting business folks in the black community, business folks in the white community, I'm running to be the mayor president for every single person. This is a reason why I'm not running for a partisan political office. I'm running to be an executive, and Republicans want safe streets. Mm-hmm. Democrats want safe streets. Republicans want us to eliminate blight. Democrats want the same thing. And we all want to create a city parish where our young people are not fleeing Baton Rouge like they have been. And I'm running to create opportunities so that, young Republicans and young Democrats don't feel forced to leave Baton Rouge like they feel forced to leave now.
877-217-5757 and talktalklouisiana.org, getting lots of emails. This one is from Holly in the Garden District. Will you invite debates with the mayor and other candidates?
Oh, I welcome debates. And honestly, I know, in previous times we would wait until qualifying. I'm ready and willing right now. We could do it right here, Jim. I invite all of the different, organizations. When you look at the fact that voter turnout was so low last year, organizations have to invite candidates, and I want to make my appeal, and I'm pretty sure that the mayor would love to defend her record. But yes, Holly, and to anyone listening, if your organization, my cell phone number is very public, email, call, and I will show up.
Okay. Another listener wants to know, and this is something that on the surface is a peripheral issue, but it could be more than that. A new congressional district map giving Louisiana a second majority black House district was rejected yesterday by a panel of three federal judges, feeling uncertainty about district boundaries. 2-1 ruling, this was in Shreveport, forbids the use of a map drawn up in January. Now, this is likely to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Secretary of State says we need to know by May 15th, as in 2 weeks from today, otherwise we'll be running in the old district, which would be a victory for Garrett Graves. But what do you make of this, and where do you think it's going?
Outside of the personalities, I was the chair of the Legislative Black Caucus when this started, and I made sure that we had a demographer. I made sure that we had maps. Math is math, right? No matter if you're a Democrat or a Republican, right? 30% of six is not one. And the numbers dictated, and the Supreme Court has said it in Alabama, and they're going to say it here in Louisiana. At this point in time, I think the goal is to run out the clock. But at the end of the day, the numbers suggest that Louisiana will have a second majority district. It's going to happen. I'm concerned about whether it happens this year. But the law is on the side. The numbers are on the side. And I believe the Supreme Court has already spoken on this issue.
Well, they did in a similar case in Alabama.
Most definitely.
But I don't know about this May 15th deadline.
And that's a challenge, right?
And why is that being, the qualifying's not until August. Why is that?
I think you might have to ask Nancy Landry, the Secretary of State.
Well, we'll see. Yeah. But But this is far from over, and as we saw with St. George.
Oh, that's so far from over as well.
Yeah, well, but you can win every lower court ruling, and then if the high court says nope.
That's right. You
that's
know,
the way it is.
It's a concern.
This attempt for a rehearing, do you think it'll go anywhere on St. George?
As a lawyer, the Supreme Court rarely ever reverses itself, right? And I've read the ruling. The ruling does speak to the fact that we don't know what the incorporation date is. We don't know the boundaries. While hopeful, as a lawyer, a practicing lawyer, I have not seen the Supreme Court change their mind.
But these areas have been annexed out of St. George, including Woman's Hospital, including the Mall of Louisiana, many of the economic engines. It could be a real mess.
Yeah, and I suspect many more. I suspect many more annexations are going to come now that this is a reality. And my number one concern when we talk about differences in how Ted James would lead, mm-hmm. in 2020, there was a committee that was established, five people. What we saw on Monday was that committee has been working very hard, and they have a binder full of information. The city parish has had an opportunity to appoint someone to that committee, and we neglected to do so. That is a problem, right? I understand as a lawyer, you fight, you file a lawsuit, you fight. But as a chief executive of a parish, you also have someone in the room to represent the interests of those of us that are still in Baton Rouge. And that hasn't been done, and I believe that that's negligent.
Well, this is 86,000 people. It will be the fifth largest city in the state of Louisiana, St. George, Louisiana. And it sprawls for miles and miles from LSU almost to Denham Springs. Places like Gardere conveniently cut out. Another good question from a listener, why wasn't there a strong move to have the whole parish vote rather than just the people in that district?
You're talking to the person that filed the bill. I filed the bill not once but twice, and it didn't get legs in the legislature, right? And, I was one, and the mayor, we both, right? And this is, again, I am disappointed as a resident of Baton Rouge with the ruling. As mayor president, I am going to wrap my arms around the city of St. George just like I'm going to wrap my arms around the other city. But Ted James is the person that filed the bill in the legislature, and it didn't pass. But I wanted it to be a vote of the entire parish. And I would be, remiss if I didn't say that, there were a lot more folks that fought for that, but we just didn't have the votes in the legislature.
877-217-5757. We're going to take a short break and return with former state representative Ted James, now endeavoring to be mayor president of East Baton Rouge Parish, running against his former political ally, Sharon Weston Broome, who is seeking a third term. It should be a race for the ages, and we'll be covering it all the way to the finish line. Likely a November election with a December runoff. We'll talk more when we return after this. This is Jim Inkster, and you are listening to Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. Jeff Palermo, the news director at the Louisiana Radio Network, has informed me qualifying is actually July 17th through the 19th. And that's not only for mayor, it's for the presumed congressional district. But this May 15th arbitrary deadline by Nancy Landry, the Secretary of State, seems like it could be adjusted to at least give the Supreme Court time to weigh in on this case involving the congressional remap. And you can imagine I'm getting all kinds of emails regarding this. The ACLU says we will continue to fight for a map that fairly represents Black Louisianians during and beyond the 2024 congressional elections. But the map, like if a map were drawn just of your mayoral parish lines, East Baton Rouge Parish, that would be almost enough for a congressional district. And as we know, we've elected five straight Black mayors. Mm-hmm. We as East Baton Rougeans, collectively, we voted for Obama twice. Right. So Black people can win here. Why not? Baton Rouge now has two districts, one from here to the Arkansas line and one from here to Shreveport. No. So it probably could have been done in a more compelling way.
I'm pretty sure that the legislature drew the best map that they could draw, right? As a native son of Baton Rouge, would I prefer a legislative, a congressional map that has Baton Rouge intact? I would prefer that. Would I prefer the numbers of African Americans accurately represented in Congress? I would want that I've demanded it. I worked hard for it before I resigned, and it's going to happen, right? As mayor president, if we have three congressional members, they're going to have regular meetings with me, because I think that being a good steward of the tax dollars means that we spend a lot of time in D.C. bringing the tax dollars back to the capital of this state, and that hadn't been done to the level of which I'm satisfied. So no matter who the congressman is, I am going to be working with them, beating the doors down on the agencies in D.C. to bring money back to East Baton Rouge Parish.
Speaker Mike Johnson, who served in the state legislature with Ted James, has released an announcement on Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene's announcement. She intends to call for a vote to remove the Republican Speaker of the House. He is succinct, saying the motion is wrong for the Republican conference, wrong for the institution, and wrong for the country. And lo and behold, Mike Johnson, who, as we know, is about as conservative as they come, is going to probably be bailed out by Democrats. That's why I love this. Every day is an adventure. And who would have thought? Who would have thought, Ted James, that your housemate Mike Johnson, who was a backbencher, is leader of the U.S. House of Representatives?
You know, I sat right next to Mike Johnson. You know, Speaker Johnson. Let me give him the respect that he's due. In Judiciary Committee, right? I see it as unfortunately in Congress, they vote strictly party lines, right? It is a benefit to East Baton Rouge Parish to have a Speaker of the House from Louisiana, no matter how you slice it. I disagree with Mike Johnson on several political issues. If Mike Johnson is the Speaker once I'm elected, he and I will be working very closely together to bring resources to East Baton Rouge Parish. If Hakeem Jeffries, my fraternity brother on the Democratic side, becomes the Speaker of the House, if Democrats take, I will work extremely hard with Speaker Jeffries to make sure that we bring in resources back to East Baton Rouge Parish.
Well, that nexus between Congress and the mayors of any city, any municipality in Louisiana, it's important.
It is important, and I don't think that we've utilized it enough, and it's one of the reasons why I'm running. Being a good steward of our tax dollars means that we don't send back money to HUD. It means that we bring money out of the nation's capital back to the Louisiana state capital. We're going to do that in the legislature, and we're going to do it in the United States Congress a lot more than what we're doing now.
Okay. I'm sure that Mayor Broome would respectfully disagree with you on whether she has done a good job. As far as I know, she gets along well with the members of the delegation.
Getting along well is a great thing, right? And for me, good is not good enough for the city that raised me, okay, right? We should be, with the relationships we have, we should have several projects coming from the bipartisan infrastructure law in this parish, right? We should not be sending money back to HUD. There should be news articles about HUD secretary is offended that the mayor of Baton Rouge continues to beat on her door asking for more money, right? Those should be the stories that are out there, and good is not good enough to me, and I'm not running because everything is bad. I'm running because I have the belief and I have the energy to do better, right? You mentioned that the mayor and I are former allies. We're still allies, right? If we are running for the same reason to make East Baton Rouge Parish better, we're still allies. I look at this race as that we are both quarterbacks on the football team, but only one of us could start.
All right.
And I intend to start.
Well, and one of you will almost certainly be the next mayor. And we hope that you both will work together because you're both substantial people important to our community.
And that's my commitment. And I look forward to debating the issues when the mayor is ready.
Okay. Thank you, Ted James. And we're joined by a couple of important people involved with the mayor's office and employ BR to discuss the mayor's youth workforce experience and certified nursing program. Two people with great names, Amanda Stanley and Gurley Anderson, and good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good morning, and we got him, Robin? Okay. Well, tell us about Employ BR. I know it's involved with the Workforce Development System and is designed to provide a workforce delivery environment for people in Baton Rouge, employers and job seekers. How's it going?
It's going great. So Employ BR is the mechanism for the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, some federal dollars that we get to employ citizens of Baton Rouge. We're here to get those that need work to work, the most underserved in our community. And we're also here to help employers find the talent that they need to keep that talent right here in East Baton Rouge Parish.
All right. And this is not a particularly new endeavor, is it? It's been going on for a little while.
Oh, it's been going on for quite a while. It started out way back in the 60s under a couple different names, and now we're under the maybe fourth or fifth iteration of it.
All right. Well, thank you, Amanda. And this is a collaboration between the mayor president, Employee BR, and Big Buddy. And Gurley, I know you're involved with this. Tell us about your association and how you did become involved.
Okay. Hi, my name.
We know your name, yeah. So keep.
So we are collaborating with Mayor President Sharon Weston Broom, Big Buddy, to employ 500 students this year, ages 14 to 24. We're going to be creating pathways for them to have to discover their interests, build skills, and explore careers through work experiences.
Well, it's conducting Employee BR, a 9-week training program for residents to become certified nursing assistants at local hospitals. How's that going, Amanda?
It is going great. We had such a great turnout. There's such an interest. And the great thing about the Certified Nursing Assistant Program is that it is a pathway for our citizens to get into healthcare and then hopefully to expand their career opportunities once they have that employment. So they can go on to LPN, PN, they can go as far as they want to once they're actually in the system and have that basic foundation.
And how many people are enrolled?
We have over 170 people that have expressed interest. We're right about maybe 100 that have enrolled.
Yes. So we've had three completed classes, and we have three more that are currently in session.
Well, this summer, and you noted this, 500 kids and young people, 14 to 24, are participating in job experiences and professional development. That's a good number. And local businesses are essential to it, aren't they?
They are. The success of the program for the Mayor's Youth Workforce Experience is going to rely on businesses working with us to be host sites for our youth. Mayor Broom has really emphasized the importance of those youth having the experience out at actual work sites. So we're really looking for employers to partner with us and give our youth that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. And a listener asked about the funding mechanism for this. I believe it's under the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act.
It is. So we are federally funded through the WIOA program.
And that was a 2014 initiative under President Obama.
Yes.
And yearly summer programs create a pathway for success. As we know, we've got challenges in Baton Rouge, but this is one of the success stories. But businesses who want to apply as host sites, they need to do it quickly, don't they?
They do. We're getting ready, and we are ready for you to call, email, text us, whatever you need to do to give those opportunities for our young folks.
And it's a May 10th deadline. For those who want to make contact, Gurley, best way to do it is?
brla.gov/mayorsyouthworkforce.
You might want to say that again, slowly.
brla.gov/mayorsyouthworkforce.
This is an important part of our community because if we are to get better, and that's our goal, no matter who the mayor is, we've got to work together. And we've got to stimulate growth among the young people who will be the future of Baton Rouge. So thank you, Amanda Stanley, Gurley Anderson. Any parting thoughts, Amanda?
No, it's great to be here, Jim. I've been a longtime listener, first-time caller. I'm so thrilled just to see you in person. Well, I feel kind of starstruck.
Well, we'll have to bring you back. You know how to make me feel 6 feet tall. So. We'll leave with Jason at Jones Creek commenting about the cemetery, Magnolia in particular. Jason writes, I've read that as the Civil War progressed, the Battle of Baton Rouge unfolded. The intersection of Florida and North 22nd was a major site of fighting. Many of the soldiers were taking cover behind the grave markers and trees in that area. The intersection was in an area where some of the fallen soldiers were also buried. The military cemetery was not yet there. Of course, it is right across the street. The book that details this is from Thomas Ritchie, The Battle of Baton Rouge. That's from Jason at Jones Creek. And until tomorrow, for Robin and Renee and Amanda and Gurley, I'm Jim Inkster. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and stay tuned.